I'll start on my clock and then stop on that clock, and I'll get 48 minutes out of class. I work out. It's good to have all of you here for a midweek service. We're continuing our class that we had titled Faithful in Our Generations that we started last week. Before we dive in, Randy's going to lead us in a word of prayer, and then we'll go ahead and get started, if you would, sir. So last week we started and we talked about generations and how the Bible talks about generations. So of course it's appropriate to start with a pop quiz. We talked about two general things that the Bible describes generations as doing, as interacting with each other. Two ways in which generations interact with each other. Anybody remember either one of those? So we're passing down, right? One generation is passing down to the next, okay? So that's probably the most basic idea that we have in the Bible of generations, is you have faith, wisdom, experience, knowledge being passed and handed down to the next generation and so on continually. What was the other? It's a little more vague. Huh? Passing up sounds like it should be the other one, right? Yeah. That would be good. The one that the way I said it was in sharing that there, God seems to describe the different generations working together in different ways. So they might they have different tasks that they need to work together on. Different generations have different strengths. One group might have a lot of wisdom. One might have a lot of passion and enthusiasm. Or the way John said it in 1 John. One group, the youngest group, just knew that their sins were forgiven, and that was all they needed to know right now. And then the older group knew God deeply, and then there was a group in the middle that was kind of in the trenches fighting evil, and all three of those comprised the church in 1 John chapter 2. So there was a sharing of what they had to offer each other. So we might, you know, might say it passing up and passing down, going back and forth. And then we ended last week with a really good question, because it's one thing to say, yes, generations pass down faith. What happens when it doesn't seem like that has worked well? Okay, it's certainly not an easy process in our experience, is it? Right, that you rarely have generations back to back to back to back of people that share faith in the same way and the same amount of conviction and the same expression of that conviction. In the Bible, that's noticeable in the sense that very faithful people often have really lousy kids. Okay, so look at David. Which of his kids turned out okay? I don't know, maybe none of them. Solomon was the better of them, but as we'll talk about today, if I get there, Solomon had a rough go of it too, right? So you might even want to say that. So it's definitely, it wasn't easy. You would think, well, David's a great fellow, and his kids just turned out to be great, and it doesn't work out that way. David has his own faults and flaws, actually. None of the Bible heroes, Eli, who is the priest at the time of Samuel, his kids are a mess. So things kind of get handed over to Samuel instead. How did Samuel's kids turn out? About the same as Eli's, right? So that it definitely is a problem. The passage we looked at, and here's where we're going to start for tonight's text, basically, is Proverbs 22 and verse 6, which makes a statement, like most statements in the Proverbs, that sounds really simple and easy, but then in actual experience, it doesn't seem like it works that way. Who wants to read for us Proverbs 22, verse 6? Donnell, thank you.
Train up a child in the way he should go,
Okay. So that's the statement that we're questioning, because that makes it sound easy. But as we said, in our experience, it doesn't seem that easy. Each generation is to pass faith and wisdom to the next generation, but we see a lot of examples of generations that seem to miss the handoff. How come? I don't have one answer to that, because I don't think there is a one-size-fits-all answer. I don't think it's the same reason every time. But I'll give you five different things that help me understand this passage and how it works in real-life families and in congregations. Okay. Number one is this. We need to notice that Proverbs are not promises. This is the hardest one, actually. Because when you read that, it sounds a lot like a promise. If you do this, this will happen. And if I were in another book of the Bible, I would assume that means if you do this, it'll happen every time, because that's the way, you know, statements work, right? But in the Proverbs, the book of Proverbs are stated, well, it's a book of, as we call them, Proverbs. What is a proverb? A proverb is a generally true statement. It's not attempting to be a statement that applies to every situation. It's not even claiming that it can never be the other way. Proverbs, just by definition, if I give you a proverb, a saying, a piece of wisdom, that I'm saying, this is something that's true most of the time. These are collected and put in God's words, which means to me they are the most reliable proverbs that you could ever have, but they're still proverbs. And even the book of Proverbs doesn't claim that in absolutely every case it works out just this neatly. And let me give you some examples. If you're in Proverbs, just skip back a couple of chapters to 17, and we'll just look at a couple of verses as examples. Proverbs 17, somebody, if you would, volunteer to read verse 2. Who would like 17:2? James, thank you. Okay, very simple statement. Even sounds like a promise. If you're a good servant, you'll come out better than a foolish son. A wise servant will come out better than a foolish son. Okay? Is that true? Yeah, in the sense that proverbs are true. It's often the case that a hardworking, wise, diligent person will get farther in life than the person who kind of has, as we say, the silver spoon in his mouth, who doesn't know what he's got. Does that make sense? Is that always true? Has there ever been a time when a very dumb son did really well and the hardworking servant got nothing? Everyone says, oh, well, yeah, that happens, right? So, yeah, it does happen. Of course it does. But what is the wisdom that we teach our children? Which one is the ground rule, usually the case statement? Hard work pays off. That's the sentiment of the proverb. A good servant gets ahead. That's the kind of thing you want to teach your children. Now, at some point, yeah, you have to have that other conversation and say, and sometimes it doesn't seem like it works out that way. This is a proverb. It's usually true. It's true more often than it's not, but it's still a proverb. It's just kind of a saying to help you arrange your life. Does that make sense so far? I'll give you another one. Someone read for us verse 8 in the same chapter. If you'd like to read verse 8 of chapter 17. Edwin, thank you. This one's kind of funny because it says bad things work. That's a funny proverb, right? Bribes will get you ahead. Isn't that a funny thing to read in your Bible? Now, is that true? In our experience, it seems like a lot of times bribes, it's not saying it's a good thing. It's not even saying you should do it. It's just saying, son, you need to know that this is how the world works. A lot of times when you can't understand why something happened the way it did, some money changed hands, right? And so it's an expression of that. Does it work every time? Did anybody ever go to jail for trying to offer a bribe to somebody who was honest? this week. Yeah, it absolutely doesn't always work. Sometimes justice actually does win, and we want children to know that too. But it's one of those things that you want to convey to your kids. Here's a general rule you ought to be aware of. Sometimes things get done because money changes hands, and you need to be aware of it. That's not even new. Apparently, it goes back to the time of Solomon, right? People were offering him money, I'm sure. Okay. 30 pieces of silver bought quite a lot. Yeah. So, definitely. Okay, let me give you one more example. Just skip to the next chapter, chapter 18, verse 23. Somebody want to read? Bobby, go ahead. 18:23. So the basic sentiment is, if you're poor, you have to say please. You have to beg. If you're rich, you can demand things. Okay? Is that generally true? Yeah. I've said this before. I don't know if you get tired of me saying it, but I jokingly have said our family motto is... beggars can't be choosers. My dad said that so many times growing up, that we grew up kind of poor. And if somebody offered you something, you didn't get to ask, well, that's not the one I wanted. They offered you one. And so you said, thank you. And that was all you got. Beggars don't get to be choosy. It's not the way it works. People without a lot get to say thank you and please and be glad for what you got. There was some kids who are about my height, but about 4 or 5 years older than me, that went to church at Seminole where I grew up. And it was important for me to watch what he was wearing because I was going to get to wear it in a couple of years. He would hand off his clothes to his mother, would hand it off to my mother, and I'd be wearing that before long. So I paid attention to what he wore from time to time, you know, because I was going to get it eventually. And we said thank you. Right? Now, is that always the case? Can a poor person be belligerent and rude? Can a rich person be polite? It happens. But as a general piece of wisdom to hand to children to live by is, you know, beggars can't be choosers. When you don't have much, you get to be grateful for what you have. You ask politely. Sometimes people who have a lot take it for granted and can be rude about it. Okay. So my point is that's the kind of statements that are in Proverbs. They're stated as facts, but the heading of the book is Proverbs. And so it tells you right up front, these are little pieces of wisdom. Shouldn't use them as promises. That'll always be the case. So when chapter 22, verse 6 says, raise a child in the way that he shall go, when he was old, he will not depart from it. Is that true? It is. I can tell you that your child is more likely to be faithful as an adult if you attempt to raise them in faith than if you attempt to teach them sin. Right? If you raise them to be worldly, I can tell you how that turns out. That one's just about 100%. Whereas if you teach them faith, there's at least some reasonable possibility that they're going to be faithful. And so that's what we teach our children. That's what we tell parents. Is it always true? Not in every application. There are other circumstances. It's a proverb. Okay? So point number one about that is chapter 22, verse 6 is a proverb, not a guarantee that as long as you go to church, your children will go to church and their children will go to church and it goes on forever. Because we know from experience that that's not always the way it works. Four more reasons why that might be the case. Why might it not work? It could be, just kind of start at the beginning, you're passing down things. Step one, maybe the older generation might fail to successfully pass on faith. That it's one thing to say, well, I'm a faithful person, so obviously my kids pick that up, right? But it's quite another to actually successfully hand it off. What are some reasons why the older generation might fail to pass it to their kids? And by older, I don't mean gray hair. I mean the older than the other one. I'm older than my kids, right? So what might make it so that I fail to pass on faith to my children? What are some things? A couple of things I just came off the top of my head. You might not try. Right? You might just assume that, well, I go to church, my kids will figure it out, and that's all they need to know. Maybe you never talk about it around the house. Maybe you don't put in any effort. If that's the case, no, you're not going to hand off faith successfully without some effort. Okay, so that might be one reason why it doesn't work. You might coddle your kids. Does this happen sometimes? Sure. One of my favorite verses about parenting is 1 Kings chapter 1 and verse 6. Speaking of David and his rotten kids, anybody want to read for us 1 Kings chapter 1 verse 6? Carl, thank you, sir. Okay, so he's a good-looking young man, and his father, who happens to be David, had never rebuked him. The ESV says it like this: his father never at any time displeased him. Okay, this kid was the fair-haired boy, and he had a special place in David's heart, and David never could bring himself to say anything bad to him. Nothing corrective, not a word of rebuke, never anything. Anything he wanted, he got. If you read the rest of the story, he dies. It doesn't end well, right? He's a terrible person, right? He turns out to be a horrible human being. And when we talk about parenting in the Young Families class, one of the things we repeat quite often, if you don't make your kids angry and frustrated from time to time, you're just not doing it right. Because they're supposed to sometimes be unhappy with you because they want to do things, and you're going to say, no. That's a terrible idea. I'm a grown-up and you're not. David didn't do that with this one. And it cost him. Sir? Yeah, so that one might be the other one, right? So instead of coddling, some will be continually harsh and even possibly abusive. But you don't have to be abusive to be continually harsh, to where your child is just permanently bitter. Because I can never do anything right. I never get make you happy. I never get anything right. That is as damaging as telling them they do it right all the time. Okay, so Proverbs 15 and 1 has a reference to something like that. Proverbs 15, 1. A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. Right? And I'll just tell you, plain as day, I knew a lot more about parenting before I became one. Young preacher Ben had some great sermons on parenting, and they really told people how to do it. And then God thought that was hysterical and gave me Lucas. And I love that little boy. But, you know, some parents say if we'd had that kid first, we wouldn't have had any more. We had ours first. That was Lucas. And we weren't sure we wanted another. He really was high-strung for quite a lot of years, and he's toned down some now. But, boy, till about 5 or 6, I thought, this is some kind of practical joke. Nothing that I had ever read that was supposed to work worked. Nothing I'd ever said was supposed to work worked. He's not in here, so I'll just tell you this. I probably wouldn't say it with him in the room, but being polite. He has a willpower like I have never seen in a human being that, and I believe in spanking like type discipline, I do. He has a high tolerance for pain. And we found out that that was not effective. That I would hurt myself before I paddled him enough to get a result. So I didn't give it up because I think spanking's bad. I gave it up with Lucas because I was breaking paddles. It was useless. And so we found other things. Now, you take away a PlayStation, and you got a pool of tears in a hurry. We go, aha, found it, right? You find the thing that works, and you use it. But his willpower and resolve, and so if I yelled, this proverb meant a lot to me, working with him, and still does. If I yelled at him, he bowed up, right? He got more, he dug in and entrenched and got more stubborn. So what I figured out, and it's, you know, he's 9, so I've got it all figured out now, right? It never gets any harder than this. Yeah. As of right now, I figured out that when he expects me to yell, if I whisper, he actually listens to what I say, that I have to, like, find to do the opposite of what he's prepared for, because he sets his little defense against me. And if I do the opposite, then I can sometimes get through and make my point. And when he says, well, I thought you'd be really mad, That's when I know, aha, I surprised you. And then I get really mad when he thinks I won't. But that's another story. But the point is that there is a time for a soft answer and there's a time for the other, right? That a harsh word can be destructive at the wrong moment. Yelling and screaming is not actually effective parenting all on its own. So the passage Jim mentioned, don't provoke your children to wrath. That if you create in them a permanent sense of bitterness towards you, that affects their relationship with God too. Because they learn about God from you. And if they're mad and bitter at you, a lot of times they're mad and bitter at God. Okay. So that's why we need wisdom, isn't it? Right? There is no simple blueprint where you say, just give this answer every time and it'll work every time. It doesn't work that way. Instead, you figure it out through trial and error and you do the best you can, and God help us all, right? It's not easy. But when you ask, why sometimes does it seem like the faith doesn't get handed off? Sometimes we didn't do as good a job as we thought. Turned out we yelled all the time. Or we never said anything was wrong. Or we didn't even put an effort in, right? All of those have consequences if they're out of balance. Number three, it might not be your fault. The younger generation might fail to receive it, right? The radio station's broadcasting, but the receiver's not on. That can happen too. Why does that happen? Well, we can think of a couple of reasons. I'll mention these from the Kings. For sake of time, I won't just run over there and read them, but... am I going to get it wrong? I'll have to ask Lenora. She'll know. Which one of Solomon's son? Is it Rehoboam? Is Solomon's son? I always get Rehoboam and Jeroboam mixed up. I have to ask a Bible class teacher every time. Jeroboam's the rebel. See, I was going to say it exactly backwards. Okay, so I should have read 1 Kings 12. 1 Kings 12, Rehoboam is the son of Solomon. And there's a question about taxation. Okay, so this is another one of those funny, what did Paul Harvey say? Here's the rest of the story. Solomon was rich, and he built a wonderful temple and did all these things. And as soon as he died, what was the rest of the story? People were tired of it. Their taxes were high. They were working them to death. They said, are you going to keep doing this? And Rehoboam had two sets of counselors. There were some old guys that said, if you want to endear yourself to the people, cut back on the taxes, cut back on the public projects, let people go home and work on their fields, and your father did what he did, but you don't have to do that. You can do it a little differently. Sage advice. The young men said, they listened to your dad because he was tough, and you're going to be tough too. You up their taxes, and you make them work harder, and you tell them who's boss. Who did Rehoboam listen to? The younger ones. Whose fault was that? Was it the old men's fault? Did they not give good counsel? It was great advice. But you got to listen, right? I mean, so the young man didn't listen. The radio station was broadcasting. The older generation was saying, here's what you need to know. I don't know. Now, could we blame Solomon? Is this something that maybe Solomon should have helped him with before he passed? I don't know. If you want to try that, we don't know any of that. All we know is that in this situation, he got some good advice from older men and some bad advice from the younger men, and he listened to the younger men. And I don't think you can blame the older men for that. He just wasn't listening to the right crowd. One thing we talk to kids a lot at camp, this is another one of those little proverbs we try to instill to the kids at camp. And I try to say it politely, but I never do. Your friends are stupid, is one of the things we tell them a lot. And what we mean by that, we joke about it. We make it kind of a joke. We're not trying to be mean. We just mean your friends are as inexperienced and young as you are. So when you have a problem and you go ask another person whose life is full of inexperience and problems, what do you get? Really bad advice. And so we tell them, make some friends with some old people. They know stuff. You know, I mean, you need to go find some other sources for wisdom, because when teenagers ask other teenagers for advice, we just get double bad advice, right? And that's the way it works.
That's why I like being involved. I go
to them old people. That's good. What's another thing that can happen to younger folk? 1 Kings 11, 1 through 8 is the story of Solomon. Solomon always did everything right, right? No. What went wrong with Solomon? Where did he get off center? Too many women. can you be led astray by other people you let into your life? Yeah. Okay. So, when a parent does the best they can possibly do in wisdom and discernment, and then this person runs with a bad crowd, marries a destructive person, and so on and so on. Once that person leaves the home, the parent is no longer the biggest influence in their life. That's just a fact. It's not supposed to be that way. Yeah. Yeah, I remember. So what, I don't know if you heard Lenora. Lenora said, even when you're not married, but when they go to school. Elementary, high school, and then, of course, to college. That the more they're around other people, the people that influence them change. And parents try as they might. You do the best you can, especially until they leave the house, but especially then. There's a reason there is a huge statistical dip in church attendance when teens go to college. Nobody to make them go to anymore. I mean, it happens. And we struggle with that, but it's a fact. Okay, so they can be led astray. It happens. Okay. Is that a parent's fault? Might be. I mean, it may be that they did something somewhere back there that led to that, but I can't blame a parent for that. See what I'm saying? I mean, if you are a parent and you feel to blame and you could say, I did this and it led to that, then that's your business. I don't know what to tell you. But I'm saying I can't come to you and say, hey, your kid's not a Christian. Why not? Because there's other things involved. See what I mean? There are other influences in their life. I remember when I went to college, my dad had this great talk with me. Dad's known for these wonderfully obtuse talks that he had with us. And he said, you're going off to college, and you're on your own now. Except you're not. I'm still your boss. I said, well, that was a mixed message, Dad. He goes, yep. Jim, you had a comment? There's when my first visit to Begg's football game, and they say the prayer over the loudspeaker, I said, where is the ACLU lawyer and what is happening? And I thought, yeah, we're in a different part of the world there, and there's a different culture there than in a lot of places. Does Keith have a loudspeaker prayer at Jinx? No. Right? Different culture, and it's not Keith's fault. It's just a different environment with a lot of Christian coaches there. It's just a different environment, size of school, attention it gets. So it definitely does depend on where you end up, on kind of what influences there are, that's for sure. Yeah, that's it. But there are some out there that are definitely negative. I'm always hesitant to say it's getting worse because, like, every generation thinks it's getting worse. But it does kind of feel like it's getting worse. I'm really hesitant to say it, but there are more people working harder to make it worse than there were in the past. It doesn't mean we were innocent in the past, okay? But there are more people working harder to be a negative influence on children than even just a few years ago. Normal kind of community standards are different of behavior.
I might say my kids, they remember the times I was real hard on things.
Yeah.
But they never tell me about the times when I was hard.
It's funny, selective memory, right? Yeah. Fourth thought, why does it seem like sometimes our kids don't pick up the faith that we hand them? One thing, and this was actually a point that was made to me by a very old Christian who said, well, Ben, you're not even reading it right. It doesn't say If you hand off faith to your children, they'll never misunderstand everything and they'll always get everything right all the days of their life. It says, when they are old, they'll not depart from it. And the way he read this, and he wasn't a preacher or anything, he was a guy who'd been in a church all his life, sitting in a pew, and said, Ben, this is the way I read it. I think he might have been right. Was that even when kids do miss the boat at some point in life and make bad decisions, if they were raised in a Christian environment, they have something to go back to when all else fails. And it may take a while. It may take some of us a long while. But there's something there to go back to. They know what a home looked like. They know what a church looked like. They know some values. Values they may have intentionally rejected. That happens. Maybe they said, I'm not sure. I want to go try my way for a while. And maybe we all have done that at some point to greater or lesser degrees. Some of us spend a long time in the far country and sometimes not so long. But having a home to come back to, and I mean that in the sense of faith, to know that there was some faith planted early on is important. I was doing some homework today, just curious. This is nerdy stuff, but just hang on a second. Hayward and Cross are professors at the University of Michigan. In 2015, they released a study they had done. It's 33 years worth of data. Okay, so sometimes when you see a study, they ask 500 people. This study had 726,977 respondents from age 12 all the way up to 104 in 80 countries over 33 years. Okay, and the question was, what happens to faith with age? Anybody want to guess what the answer is? Go ahead. It increases. Yeah, I mean, like you didn't even need a probably a very expensive study to tell you that. But someone did it, and it turned out, oh, what do you know? People in their 20s and 30s aren't very interested in church. They're interested in a lot of other stuff. If they are interested in church, it's a great treat. But by and large, that crowd into their 30s and 40s is not as interested. When do people start getting very interested in church? What are some moments in life where it happens? Okay, scary life experience. Something bad happens and you say, I got to get to church. When you have a kid and you say, I have no idea what to do with this kid, I got to get to church. That happens. Parent dies and you face mortality and you feel untethered to your source of wisdom and know-how and wisdom and you go looking for some of those old people you didn't like. Where do you find them? At church. What else? Old age. You don't know anything about that, Lenora, so don't you worry about it. But Lenora said, when you figure out you don't have as many years left as you used to, you start thinking about maybe I ought to go to church. What about career? People deep in their career, sadly, think that's the most important thing. And so 6 days a week are work, work, work. Sundays are for blowing off steam. See? What happens when you change different point in your career? Do people sometimes say, that wasn't very meaningful after all. I wish I had something in my life that meant something. And they're looking for it. Yeah. There was a much smaller study done recently that I don't think I put it on the screen. But this one has been tracking about 30,000 baby boomers. So who are the baby boomers? We'll get to this next week, by the way. Who are the baby boomers? 50s, early 60s, right? And they grew up. And by and large, part of a lot of the kind of cultural shift that took part in those decades that followed, okay, as a whole, have been known for being not as much in church as their parents were. About 20% of baby boomers that were in this study, of about 30,000, say in the last 5 years they've become more religious than they were at any other point in their life. How come? Getting old. Their friends are dying. And they're starting to think maybe I ought to be in a church. Right? It happens. So every time there's a generation that goes out and does wild stuff, there's all these books written about, this is the worst generation. Because baby boomers, you were it, right? Remember? You were the worst generation that had ever lived. You had all the hippies. You ruined America, and they ruined churches. And then guess what? Now you're all in church. Right? And that happens. Now guess what all the books are about? Millennials. Millennials are all clueless. They're the only generation that's going to stop going to church permanently. They'll never come back and wait a while. I'm not saying you can't permanently mess it up. I'm not saying that we couldn't get it wrong and maybe we do break the system. And maybe there is a generation that doesn't come back if we don't do our job right. And it does happen. The Northern Kingdom, Israel, was a nation that never came back. Right? Judah would make a mistake and fix it, make a mistake and fix it, make a mistake and fix it. And they just kind of kept on going around in cycles. The Northern Kingdom just slid down the hill and were wiped out. So can you ruin a whole culture? Sure, you can. But you don't necessarily write kids off because in their 20s and 30s, they're doing stupid things. Okay, and neither do you condone it. Let me say that. I don't like it when preachers say, oh, well, they're in 20 or 30s, it's fine, you know, go do whatever. That's not helpful either. You don't condone it. But neither do I become pessimistic and say, well, that generation's lost. Because that's what they said about your generation, too. Here you are, right? So just keep that in mind. Any questions on that one? Because I think that's actually very helpful, and we want to talk about that some more next week. Okay. Fifth thought, then. This one's a little more tricky, so let me think about it here and how to say it. The faithfulness of one generation may not look like the faithfulness of the next generation. And what I mean by that is the next group may be faithful, but some other things may have changed, and we look at it and say, well, they're not being faithful because they didn't do it like I did it. When in fact, maybe they're being faithful in a different set of circumstances. And let me tell you what I mean by that. A couple of biblical examples. I'll just give you two or three that come to mind. In 2 Chronicles chapter 30, let's see if my memory works. Hezekiah is king, and they haven't been having the Passover. And so somebody says, we're supposed to celebrate the Passover. Okay? So it comes time for the Passover, and they're getting ready for the Passover. About that time, the Northern Kingdom has been annihilated. And all these refugees from the Northern Kingdom kind of filter down into Judah. They haven't been keeping Passover for ages, right? And so they're all there. You got these people who haven't done it in a while, and people haven't done it in a long while. And they say, let's do the Passover. Well, that's the problem. The priests go and look at the law. And they say, well, there are rules for the Passover. People are supposed to be clean, ceremonially clean. And that may take months. And Passover is less than a month away. So they had to make a decision. What are the options? We cannot keep the Passover, which is breaking God's law, right? Because he said keep the Passover. We could keep it incorrectly by letting unclean people keep it, or we could move it a month, try to get as many people ceremonially clean as possible, and do it a month late, which is still against the rules, but a different way. Okay? Anybody know off the top of your head which one they picked? Number three, they moved it a month, and they prayed to God. Hezekiah and the priests prayed to God, and they said, we don't know what to do. We don't want to skip it. We don't want to do it wrong. But all we come up with is postponing it. And they said, God, have mercy. And in the text, it says God heard their prayers and blessed them because they did the best they could with the bad situation. Right? There was no good answer. It was a situation where they needed to repent, and they didn't know how because they hadn't been doing right for so long. They didn't know how to get back to good, right? And so they did the best they could. Were they faithful? I think they were, given their circumstances. Had some other generation willy-nilly said, hey, let's move it a month just for fun, that's when I expect to see lightning come from the sky, right? God doesn't like that. But when this generation, in a very difficult circumstances, said, we're going to have to make a change because it's the only way we can figure out how to do it, God looked on that with favor and blessed it. Read all of that chapter if you want. It's a very fascinating story. But it was one of those situations where a group of people were trying to do right and there was no right answer. And they said, God have mercy, we're going to do the best we can. Is our world a mess? It always has been. According to what we discussed a moment ago, it seems like sometimes it's getting messier. How are our kids going to be Christians in the world that we've left them? They've got some tough choices. And there may be days where it doesn't look like the way my mom and dad did it. Because they're in a world that we made, by the way, that we're responsible for. And so in some ways, I've got to trust and say, I'm going to teach my kid the best I can and hope he has the wisdom and the good sense of Hezekiah to pray and do the best he can. And I have to be careful about saying, well, that's not the way I did it. Another example of that is in Ezra chapter 3, where they're consecrating the temple. And the temple wasn't as pretty as it had been. Years and years before, it had been beautiful. And at this time, they had rebuilt it. But these are poor refugees rebuilding a temple, not Solomon building a massive, beautiful temple at the height of his wealth. So it's not very impressive. And there's two groups of people. The younger refugees, who had never seen the old temple, are shouting and rejoicing. The older refugees, who remember the temple, are crying because they said it doesn't look anything like it used to. Whose fault was it that it doesn't look anything like it used to? Nobody living. This was a problem that went back. Why was the temple destroyed in the first place? What were they supposed to do? They did the best they could. And Haggai actually mentions this. Read Haggai chapter 2. He says, most of you weren't alive to see it anyway. Haggai's an old man. He's the old prophet. And he says, none of you were alive to see it anyway. I did. It's okay. Go worship. And that's his point. He says, you do the best you can, and you go and you be faithful in the circumstances you're handed. And no, it's not going to look like the way it was. But it wasn't that great back then either. How do I know? Because they got destroyed and they went into captivity. So before I say, why doesn't my kid want to do it just the way I did it? I remember that I made the mess he has to fix anyway. My way wasn't that great. It contributed to a lousy world. I did some things right, and I did some things not so right. And so did you. And if the world is still spinning, so will my kids. And so faithfulness might not always look the same. Turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 7. This will be our last passage for tonight. Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verse 10. Somebody want to read for us Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 10. James, thank you, sir.
Do not say, why is it that the former days were better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask about.
What does he say? Now, this is interesting because this book comes right after Proverbs. Proverbs says, listen to your parents. They're telling you the best wisdom they've got. Listen to them. We talked about that last week. Ecclesiastes has this verse that says, parents, be careful. It's dangerous to go around asking, why aren't things the way they used to be? He says, that's not a wise question to ask. Why isn't it wise? I don't know, ask Solomon. But he says, it's a dangerous question. It can make you bitter because you want things to be back the way they were. It can make you overlook good things that are happening now because they aren't the things that you wanted to happen. It can alienate you from people that are doing good things now because you're suspicious of them because they're not doing it the way that we did it. So Solomon says, it's important to pass on wisdom. But then he says, it's very dangerous. It is not wise to go around asking, why aren't things the way they used to be? He says, that's not a good question to ask. And it's interesting that this book comes right after Proverbs. So which one's true? Yes, they're both true. Pass down wisdom, but be aware that, like it or not, your kids aren't going to do everything the way you had planned. And some things, even some faithful things, may look different sometimes. And that's a hard thing for me to swallow for sure. Okay. Next week, we're going to pick up there and talk some more about generations. I appreciate the feedback and discussion, like after class and during class. So far, this has been a lot of good discussion. I appreciate it.